Hi, and welcome to this month's CIO live stream. I am joining you live from the global headquarters of the world's best capitalized bank, headquartered in the world's best capitalized country. Warm welcome to those watching the public portion of this on LinkedIn. In the first part of the live stream, we're going to talk about latest developments in the Middle East. We're going to talk about the U.S. economy, and then in the second half of the podcast, we're going to talk about top investment recommendations. So let's get into it. You know, I think one of the things that we get a lot of client questions about are geopolitical tensions in the Middle East and what's going on with inflation. So to make a start, let's turn to Themis. And Themis, can you update us on the Middle East and you know, how we should think about geopolitical issues at this point in portfolios?
Thanks, Mark. The situation in Middle East remains quite tense. But having said that, if we look at the recent response from Iran to the reported attack of Israel on its consulate in Syria, and the subsequent reaction of Israel to the attack by Iran on Israeli soil, those reactions seem to be well calibrated to avoid further escalation of the conflict. And it is our view that it is of no interest for Iran or Israel or the West to allow that conflict to escalate. But this is a fine line, and the tensions will continue. And given that the recent level we achieved with direct attacks between Iran and Israel, the risk of miscalculation is there. So things can still escalate at some point in the future. You asked a question about how we should think in terms of portfolio positioning. If you look at the slide on the screen, we can see that in the past, for a number of geopolitical events, the market impact has not been hasn't lasted long. And you can look 1 week or 1 year from the time of the geopolitical event, and we can see that in the majority of cases, actually the markets ended up at a higher level than just before the event. Having said that, obviously clients could continue to worry about the potential escalation. And for investors that are worried about this outcome, there's a couple of things they can think about. Most likely transmission mechanism for that escalation of conflict is going to be the oil price. If we have disruptions in the oil flows, that could result in higher oil price, could result in higher inflation, higher rates, and soil economic environment. So investors can think about having some exposure to oil price. And for us, anyway, we see some upside in that commodity, even if based on fundamentals. The other commodity that could provide some risk to geopolitics is gold. And we've seen gold reacting to the recent escalation as well. And fundamentally, you also like gold because we do think that when the Fed starts cutting interest rates and declining real rates, that should be supporting for gold. And of course, it has the added ability to protect against geopolitical risk. And the very final way to think about hedging against escalation is U.S. Treasuries, where again, we're positive in that asset class because we do expect the Fed to cut rates and on top of it, flow to safety assets is also an asset class that should be benefiting.
Thanks, Themis. And I think just one thing to add, maybe a little bit of a clarification, you know, further escalation of a conflict between Israel and Iran is what you were talking about. And that's not in anybody's interest. On the other hand, you know, a more contained conflict continuing to go on around Israel against Hamas and Hezbollah, that's probably something where we still may see, you know, more what is now being termed kinetic action in the near term, but I think we're drawing this distinction about further escalation beyond that immediate conflict is something that the markets are more likely to react to. You know, with that, I think the pivot to Nadia and what's going on in the U.S., although it's not necessarily that much of a pivot because all these things are linked. And certainly, you know, one of the things we saw is the U.S. Congress responding and now sending aid in part into the Middle East. Nadia, start taking us through, you know, what's going on in the U.S. and how's it being reflected in the economy?
Yes, thank you for that, Mark. So, you know, what's been going on in D.C., I would say the last few months have been a bit stormy with debates over foreign aid package. But finally, as you noted last week, the U.S. Congress did pass and President Biden did sign into law the $95.3 billion foreign aid package. And that includes aid to Ukraine, Israel, Taiwan, humanitarian aid for Gaza, as well as some additional sanctions on China, Russia, and Iran. The outlays in the package are expected to be spread out over multiple fiscal years. A good portion of it, Mark, though, is going to go to the U.S. Defense industry, and that includes replenishing some of the weapons and equipment stocks that was drawn down over the last year plus. You know, unfortunately, you know, we live in a world of heightened geopolitical tensions, as you heard Themis discuss, some of which is leading to major humanitarian crises. But it also means that countries and governments will be spending more to modernize their defense system to really protect their borders interests as well as those of their allies. Now, with that, Mark, let me shift gears and specifically talk more about the U.S. economy rates and where we see those going. Last week, we did get the first reading of first quarter U.S. GDP, and that missed expectations. It came in at 1.6% and really marked the slowest pace since the second quarter of 2022. And what it did was it interrupted what had been six consecutive quarters of above trend growth. But when you peel back the onion, some of the components were quite encouraging still, not as anemic as the headline number would have suggested. Specifically, personal consumption remained strong at 2.5%, in particular strength in services. So when you couple that with the robust labor market that's in the U.S., the unemployment rate is relatively low at, you know, 3.8%. We'll get the next payroll data this Friday, and that data is likely to remain solid. You know, we could see, though, a bit of a step down from the brisk pace that we've seen over the last 3 months, where we had an average of 265,000 jobs being created on a monthly basis. But nonetheless, you know, there is 1.4 job openings for every unemployed person in the U.S. And so what that does, it does suggest to us that the economy and the consumer should remain fairly resilient. If we can go to the slide that's up, with, you know, with consumption sort of remaining solid, inflation has been a bit more mixed. In the recent month, we have had hotter than expected inflation. The PCE, which is, as we know, the Fed's preferred inflation measure, last Friday we got that core came in line with expectations at 2.8% year over year. That did alleviate some of the concerns from earlier in the month. But unfortunately, this morning, we did get first quarter, the Employment Cost Index, ECI, which is the Fed's preferred wage growth measure. And that surprised to the upside, that came in at 1.2% quarter over quarter. Now, Mark, that is just too high to be compatible with the Fed's 2% inflation target. So the progress on inflation has indeed slowed of late, but you know, some of this could be due to the January effects, some seasonal effects. So we need a bit more data to be able to assess fully. But we do continue to believe that the disinflation path will resume. We're seeing, you know, slowing in rent inflation, and that should help out, as well as potential slowing in auto insurance inflation going forward. So we are still believers that the U.S. economy is on track for soft landing. And what that means is, you know, roughly 2% GDP growth for 2024, inflation coming back closer to target. And that will allow the Fed to cut interest rates this year. Our core view is for 2 times, so 50 basis points starting in September. That should allow bond yields to pull back. You know, we expect the yield on the 10-year Treasury to retreat from the, you know, 4.7 level that we're seeing today and move back towards 3.85% by the end of the year. We wouldn't be surprised if tomorrow at the FOMC press conference, if Chairman Powell does downplay the March SEP. And in the medium dot, if you recall, was at 3 cuts for the year. But just given the inflation data, we won't be surprised to see if that's downplayed. But that shouldn't be a surprise to market, because the rates market is now pricing in just 1 to 2 rate cuts for this year. The market has somewhat, again, already done some of the work for the Fed by tightening financial conditions. So, Mark, some bumps along the way, but we think that the PAT remains down for both inflation, rates, and bond yields, and for growth to sort of remain around trend line for the U.S. economy.
All right. Thanks for that, Nadia. Now, as everyone knows, our favorite part of this these live streams is the questions that come in. So I'd love to have some more questions rolling in. Now, Nadia, we saw you've got a slide coming up on equity. So I think, you outlined a picture that's pretty good for bonds, but what about equities?
Yeah, we do think that the risk reward in equity is fairly balanced. We do have a neutral stance globally. But to be clear, Mark, we know that neutral does not mean that there's nothing to do under the hood and there's no upside return from here. We expect modest upside to equities. And, while there might be some pullbacks here and there, we do think that those are likely to be shallow and short-lived. We have already seen that being played out over the last month. At one point, the S&P 500 was down 5% from the late March all-time high, and that was due to a confluence of things that we discussed earlier, heightened geopolitical tension, inflation, rates backing up, and that triggered some repositioning by systematic funds. But dip buyers stepped in, particularly retail investors. And why is that? And that goes back to the simple fact that corporate fundamentals remain solid. We're seeing that during this ongoing first quarter earnings season in the U.S. We are a little more than halfway through, and companies are beating expectations. Earnings could be on pace to see low double-digit growth for the quarter, and forward guidance have been constructive. Earnings upgrades to the second quarter numbers and the full-year earnings remain largely intact and unchanged. And importantly, the consumer spending continues to be solid, particularly on services and experiences. But, let me just touch quickly on tech, because this has been an area of volatility within the U.S. market. And it is a sector that we do like globally. And it hasn't been immune to some of the macro headwinds and rates. And also there's been some misgivings around AI, which we still believe is very much in the early stages. We think that AI will have quite a bit of impact going forward on not only the economy, but also companies' revenues. But again, yet again, we saw that tech, this high quality sector, has shown its resiliency again and why it has commanded a valuation premium. The AI narrative continues to remain intact. We've seen positive outlook from mega cap tech companies. The increase in CapEx guidance, AI monetization is happening, and it's adding to revenues for some. So far, the earnings season, what we've heard is actually demand has been outstripping capacity. So growth could even be better if that capacity can catch up with the demand. But outside of AI, the sort of traditional areas of tech, so PC servers, those are also recovering, and IT budgets do remain quite healthy. So we think all of these positive trends should support the sector where, when you look at valuations are reasonable in our view. They're around 25 times forward price to earnings. And that's being supported by earnings growth. That is twice that of the market, as you can see here on the slide, and also outpacing all other sectors. So we believe that there's still more room to run in tech. And so, Mark, we've been advising taking advantage of any sort of volatility that we have recently seen in tech.
All right. Thank you for that view on equities. I was hoping we could turn to Themis and talk about UK equities. Themis, you are in the UK. What's the view on the equities in the UK?
Thanks, Mark. We actually became more positive on UK equities. UK equities has been very much a very unloved market, underperformed global equities materially over the last 12 months. And also for a variety of reasons, earnings were negative last year. If you look at, there were a lot of concerns about the local economy, inflation has been high, concerns when is the Bank of England got to cut interest rates, but a lot of that is changing. And for the current year, we're expecting earnings to start accelerating. And if you look at this slide, you can see that the UK economy has a big chunk that is exposed to commodities. And we've seen concrete signs of the manufacturing cycle globally already turning. So these commodities should be benefiting oil, metals and mining as well. But also the other quarter of the market, which is financials, we expect the bank's net interest income to bottom out in the first quarter and start getting better as the year progresses. The economy is starting to show signs of improvement as well. And we do expect the Bank of England to cut interest rates around August, if not earlier. And that should also be supporting valuations as well. So yes, the timing we think is right. Valuation is very attractive. And things are getting better for the UK market.
All right. Thanks, Themis. All right. I think this is where we're going to end the public portion of things. So I want to thank everybody.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management Business of UBS AG or its affiliate, UBS. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient and is published for informational purposes only. As a firm providing wealth management services to clients globally, UBS AG and its subsidiaries offer both investment advisory services and brokerage services. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. In the USA, UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS AG and a member of FINRA SIPC. For information, please visit our website at ubs.com/workingwithus. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.